Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to another episode of PlantWisdom.org. And today we've got a very intriguing guest. I'm so glad I was able to track her down and get a little bit of her time. You're going to see that she's a very busy person doing some very interesting work, cutting edge to say the least. In fact, we don't even have a language necessarily to explain what it is she does. But you're going to understand as we get into it, and it's going to open your mind. So our guest today is Tama Matsuoka Wong. Tama, welcome.
Hi, Ken.
it's so great to have you on the call. Tama is among other things, is the author of Foraged Flavor. This is a James Beard winner or nominee?
Nominated,
which is huge. Believe me, there's a billion cookbooks published every year, and to get nominated is massive. And a lot of people are familiar with the concept of foraging, and for those that aren't, what does that mean? It means you look around and maybe you see some dandelions or you see some chicory and you realize, wow, I could pick that, clean it up, put it in my salad, and I've got a delicious, nutritious food. Well, Tama took this to a much higher level and started working with a restaurant. What was the name of the restaurant?
So the restaurant I was working with is Restaurant Danielle.
Restaurant Danielle, and this is a serious, high-end restaurant where food is not only delicious and enjoyable, but it's an art. And you developed a relationship with them. Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship you developed with this restaurant and the chef?
Sure. Basically, the chef that I – it was just completely happenstance, Ken. So I was – had a meadow and I was looking for things in it that were edible, but I wanted great ways to work with them and to feed my family that weren't just boiling or making it into a tea or salad, as you said. And by just happenstance, some friends of ours were eating at this restaurant, which I didn't really know anything about or follow or anything. And they said that I should bring things in and tell them to cook it. So I was, a little daunted by that. But I brought things in and they made them into a great meal for that evening. And then I went back and met the chef de cuisine, Eddie LaRue. And he asked me, "So, Mrs. Wong, what else do you have in your meadow?" And I said, I was pretty much of a plant geek by then. And I said, "I have 225 plants. What are you looking for?" And he said, "Bring me everything." So I started bringing everything, and this became this, we called it the project. We didn't even know what foraging, I hadn't even heard of the word foraging then. I just wanted like recipes, and he wanted new flavors. So it ended up being this great, very intense sort of R&D thing where we kind of explored the culinary possibilities of plants around, wild plants.
And this was your meadow, and this was not something you weren't a farmer. You didn't plant these things; they were just there in your meadow.
Yes, I would say it's kind of a combination. So I actually have I have one meadow that is completely wild; it's just been restored, and there's another meadow that is a seeded meadow because it's on ground that has been dug up to have our septic field put in. So you can. It doesn't mean that you can't actually seed or plant things, but it just means that it depends on the landscape.
Gotcha. And in fact, as we were talking about before we started the recording, this practice of encouraging wild plants or specific plants to grow, not necessarily as a farmer or as a gardener, but just seeding them, giving them a chance to live and thrive. This is actually a very ancient practice. The Native Americans do it. People in the Amazon still do it today. I know people in Africa do it. It's not farming in the sense of we're going to get out the old plow and get the mule and 40 acres and all that. It's more like looking around, seeing what can thrive in a certain area, thinking about what you like and helping those things that you like that are natural to that area thrive. Is that pretty much a good description?
Yes, I totally agree, Ken. And I guess for me, it pretty much came about because I'm actually not a very good gardener. So I tried to plant things and they died. So I'm kind of like a failed gardener. And so then I started looking around and saying, okay, so what things are growing there. I paid attention because, you know, I tried to plant tomato plants and they all washed away because I live in a clay floodplain. And so it's really sort of seeing what's there, but not just automatically throwing them out because they decided to grow there, but looking at them and thinking, let me know, understand what this plant is, and then seeing whether it actually has culinary possibilities.
Well, one thing that I've always noticed and has always amazed me, I've done some gardening and it's hard work, and sometimes I was lucky, but it's work. And then I would look at the dandelions and the plantains and the chicory, and
so it's exuberant,
like,
right?
Yeah, nobody's watering them, nobody's fertilizing them, nobody's doing anything, and they're
like,
just
why not like take a look at like what wants to be there, right?
Right.
Instead of just like, okay, here's this thing, I need to have this and this and this, and I can't have anything else there except what I want to be there.
Right, right. Which is sort of, you know, it's a plantation mentality. You know, in other words, it's you know, growing is about making money. And hey, there's a big market for indigo, or there's a big market for cotton, or there's a big market for sugar cane. So we're just going to mow everything down. We're going to plow the ground up. We're going to plant nothing but sugar cane. And, you know, that's sort of, like I said, it's a plantation mentality. And it's sort of a relatively new approach to agriculture. And the more ancient approach that appears everywhere on the planet and goes back thousands and thousands of years is, hey, what's growing that we can gather, and what can we encourage that would like to grow here that we like?
Yes, and encouragement is completely the right word for it. So if there's things something that is already there and you like it, it's so much easier just to encourage it, give it a little more space, you know, to grow and more light, and it will spread, and you know, you can encourage it. But it doesn't mean like you have to have this grid of, I want to put this here and I don't want anything else to be there except the thing I decided to put there.
Great. Great. And you make this distinction that you're not a farmer, obviously, but you're also not a forager in the sense that you're not someone that's just wandering around grabbing things willy-nilly. You're in actually a middle ground. Can you describe why
So I am grabbing things, but not willy-nilly.
you're grabbing things, but not willy-nilly. So you're not a farmer, you're not a forager, you're in a different category. So explain why. Well, it's obvious why you're not a farmer, because again, you're not going to fire up the tractor at 6 a.m. and plow the field. But you're also not a forager in the sense of, well, I'm just going to fill my bushel and hit the road. Tell us about that unique place that you're occupying in between farming and foraging.
Well, I guess it really starts with, I mean, where I came from was not where I come, you know, as you know, I'm a lawyer by training, but when I came from in the plant world was from the, you know, a deep sense of wanting to restore landscapes to be more natural, and appreciating kind of the beauty and experience and sort of rejuvenation you get when you are in a natural landscape, and how far people have sort of strayed from that. You know, we have these kind of very flat, arid, manicured places that we choose to walk around in, whether it's like park-like or an ornamental garden with sort of, you know, trimmed hedges, as opposed to, you know, a landscape that is alive and is natural and the plants are exuberant. We want to be there and have seeded, you know, themselves to be there. So it kind of came from that, sort of that background of wanting to see a landscape that's more like that. And I guess we're getting back to the farmer forager thing. So then it was sort of like, if you just let things go and you don't, you know, just let's say you have a lawn, and you just say like, okay, I'm just gonna be natural about it. Let the lawn. I'm not gonna mow it. I'm just gonna get the lawn. Let the lawn just go. What happens? So about a bunch of lawn seed, right? Seed
right,
grass.
Right.
So that's not really. So you do have to do something. So there is a sense of managing it or restoring it to be the way you want. So yes, it does require. And at certain points, it may require a fair amount of work and thinking, but not in such a controlled way that everything has to be in kind of a row, in more of a natural way where you're working with nature instead of imposing your own preconceived design of what the land needs to look like.
Because
you have a map or a design, an imposed design.
Gotcha. You're starting with the nature that's there and working with it, as opposed to saying, okay, let's scrape everything away, put on this grid, and grow papayas.
Yeah, and so in a way also, in the short term, yes, you have to do work to kind of get to know it, to do what needs to be done. But over the long term, I think it's more sustainable because what is there, instead of fighting it, you're actually working with what wants to be there.
Gotcha. And are you irrigating or laying out herbicides? Are you doing any of that typical farming stuff?
Not doing that. I mean, it is kind of a battle. I mean, so for example, I did a Kickstarter for a sumac farm, and that's a whole other topic we can talk about another time. But I planted sumac, and the first year, it would have been a poison ivy farm. It would not have been sumac. Poison ivy was like hovering over the top of the sumac because it was so happy and it was invigorated or something.
Okay.
So yeah, we did have to do a little bit of like spraying of the poison ivy. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been sumac because the sumac now it's kind of fine because the sumac's big enough and we mowed down the poison ivy and it's under control. But yes, the first. I'm not kind of like this it can all or nothing type person, but I think it's more like seeing what's happening and trying to manage it to be what the landscape wants it to be. So does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And for people that don't know, some people have heard of poison sumac. We're obviously not talking about that.
I didn't plant a poison sumac farm. So.
But tell people what sumac is and why it's so wonderful.
Okay. So, I mean, the other thing, because I work with a lot of chefs who are very creative people and are totally obsessed with flavor, is that, you know, not besides the point that not all plants are the same ecologically and how they relate to land, not all plants are the same. Of course, they could be edible, but edible and delicious, there's a wide range, right, between
– right.
It's delicious versus top 10 and, you know, versus it tastes like cardboard. It can
right.
survive well
like,
from
like,
it.
Like plantain, you know, which grows everywhere. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, yes. But unless the leaves are really small, unless you have a taste for it, it's not going to be your favorite.
It's like very fibrous and it just is kind of, you know, yeah. So sumac, yes. So unfortunately, sumac seems to have a bad name. I know like all these farmers that just cut it down, and I know the highway department has been up and down Route 95 has been spraying it, I think because they think it's poison sumac. But poison sumac has a white fruit cluster, and sumac has a kind of red burgundy fruit cluster. And it is it's a really wonderfully delicious spice. The American Indians used to dry it and use it over the winter and through the season as sumac aid. It's very nutritious. It is kind of tart, citrusy, but at the same time almost like cherry and nutty flavor. So it's really great both in a flavor and nutrition point of view. But it's kind of declining. You know, you see it along the highways, you think it's a lot, but if you're actually looking for it, it's not that much around. So when you're really looking for it, so I ended up kind of doing a kind of experimental planting of sumac because there's so much that's not known about it. We haven't focused a lot of research that has gone into agriculture doesn't focus on things like this. So we don't know how many years it would take from a plug to actually yield. We don't know how to tell what a male sumac is versus a female sumac when it's a very, very young. So a lot of this is information that we're trying to build in what I'm doing.
Oh, that's fantastic because, you know, obviously commodity crops like oranges and wheat and even eggplant and all that stuff, a lot is known because people have been growing it for a long time. They grow it in huge volumes. There's a lot of money at stake. There's probably an Eggplant Growers Association of America. So the data flows. But when you're talking about the sumac tree, when you have half the country doesn't even realize the difference between poison sumac and wonderful sumac, you have a problem right there. Mm-hmm. So you found a piece of ground that sumac you believe would naturally enjoy, and you encouraged.
I think the thing is that I think a lot of people will pick something. I think it's really important to try and understand and see what's naturally growing on a place. So this was a place that. It's actually, I'm working with the New Jersey Conservation Foundation. So it's what they consider a piece of fallow land that really, it's preserved farm, but it's not really conducive to farming. And I know the farmer who preserved it, and he was like, I've got this. This is kind of what I said the conversation looks like, right? They're like, I got this, land. It's like fallow. I can't do anything with it because it's got this steep slope. So if I try and put a tractor on it, it's like the tractor's like half falling off.
Right.
And, nothing will, it's just too much of a headache. So why don't you look at it? So I look at it, I'm like, oh my gosh, perfect for sumac. In fact, sumac should be growing here, but it probably hasn't because we've just only been, on the one side is a lawn and the other side is kind of a hay field. So if we put sumac in this area, it would almost be putting back what should be there and restoring a corridor for wildlife between two sort of preserved areas. And these kind of, there's so much fragmentation of wildlife corridors now that
right.
this would be, it'd be a really good thing in kind of the bigger picture, in addition to hopefully being a crop.
Yeah, and then you can harvest it responsibly, and now it's a resource for people. Let's talk about the harvesting responsibly, and this is why you don't call yourself a forager.
I call myself a forager.
Oh, okay. But there are different ways of foraging. There are different attitudes towards foraging or different approaches.
I think that it's getting more popular, and I think that I would call anyone a forager who's picked a berry, right? You forage that. But I do think, there's a lot of enthusiastic people that haven't, really come from a background of stewardship of their own property. And so I think that's the difference in that if you're just going and seeing what you can kind of grab from nature and then you move on to the next place, it's a little different than if it's that place is your own place and you're hoping to conserve it for the next generation.
For instance, we were talking earlier about the plant, the ramp, which has become very popular.
I don't know how this happened, but for some reason, when people come, spring comes, and that people are realizing now, the farm season hasn't really, at least in the kind of temperate parts of the United States, people are sort of thinking, we don't have yet the farm crops. So it's great, but people are looking at what is there in the spring that's kind of a wild edible? And somehow people are just focused on ramps and morels when there's, so many other plants that are there and more accessible and more sustainably harvested.
Let's talk about the ramp and its vulnerability. That was very interesting what you were telling me before.
About the ramp, I go back to this is sort of what I think is that ecologically speaking, not all plants are the same. So there are some plants that have been introduced through people or through the government saying it's good because there's no pests, but they've been introduced from one way or another from other countries. And they come in, when they are introduced to a landscape here, they do not have the same controls or balances. So they may get out of control and become invasive. That's on one side of the spectrum. The other side is sort of native plants that are very specialized, meaning that they require very certain soil and other conditions. They will only grow in certain types of soils and conditions. Which is a ramp. Ramp will not grow in a farm field. And then add to that the fact that if you understand the plant more than just I see it, it looks like there's a lot, I'll take this. If you understand kind of its behavior and its growth cycle, which for a ramp, it could take 18 months to even just germinate and 3 to 5 years to mature, you sort of realize that if you really think about that, the fact that people, I think there's a study that said there's about 1 million pounds of ramps that they calculated being harvested annually in the United States, and mm-hmm. that people are pulling the entire plant out, including the bulb, which is the root, you know, the source of the food source for the plant to regenerate the next year, you're taking out probably hundreds of years of plant growth when you go along and pull out those ramp plants.
Wow. So we've got a lot to learn about how to forage responsibly and how to work with our landscapes responsibly. And one of the things we were talking about before the recording started is that the approach that you're taking is you're out in the field often all day personally harvesting and thereby getting to know the plants and getting to know the landscape. You're not just taking people on plant walks. You're actually harvesting for lack of a better word, industrial sized amounts of plants, but you're doing it with a sensitivity towards what's sustainable.
Yeah, so I'd say not industrial size, but maybe than personal size.
Commercial size, kitchen.
Yes, and the reason I kind of chose to do this is I really believe in learning by doing. And so by the fact that I'm actually in the field working with a single plant for perhaps 6 or 7 hours at a time, you really learn a lot of things about their behavior and how it is. Aside from kind of when it tastes the best, but also just like how it behaves and it's kind of rejuvenation, et cetera, year after year after year. And so I kind of chose this way, which is to have a small kind of startup business as a way of learning by doing. And I kind of felt that that was a way that for me I would have the most impact and as well as really learn by experiencing.
Gotcha. Well, I can't believe we're coming up to our time. we're clearly going to have more conversations about this because this is really interesting stuff, and I think important too. I think this is a way some people could supplement their incomes if they do it responsibly, or supplement their meals. They may have a meadow, they may have a garden that has, quote, weeds in it, and this kind of information is something that could be very useful and helpful to people. What's your vision of the future? I mean, right now you're doing things the way you're doing them. You've got your meadows and you're working with restaurants and
what I notice, again, Ken, from being out like so often, is I really notice the impact that weather's having on both wild plants and cultivated plants. And
okay.
It's very challenging. And that, you know, people are seeing like entire year's worth of crops kind of wiped out by a hailstorm or something, or it never happened before. So I definitely know, I believe and I know that weeds and wild crops in that sense are going to be somewhere in our future. And so the more that we learn about them now, the better prepared we are for future generations. And the thing that I'm kind of hoping, you know, from your audience, that people would get is just to start. I think you have to start by thinking differently about the things that you normally don't even think about. And then once you start there, you know, it's your own journey as to how far you want to take it, whether you want to actually, you know, pursue a living this way or just use it for your family or just for your personal use. But I think that, you know, the great thing about this is there could be something for everybody.
Great. And one place for people to start that I very much recommend is your book, Forage Flavor. You have beautiful pictures, photographs of the plants, so it's very clear. You also talk about what plants are for lack of a better word, endangered or need to be handled with special care.
That's the sustainability code. And in addition, there was a five-step process for identification. And I know in this day and age, a lot of people just want to see a photo and, like, match it to the photo. But if you just take a little bit of time, this kind of walks you through. And it's not an overly scientific, you know, you have to know a taxonomic description of the plant. But it gets you to sort of start to look at, okay, how does it grow? Is it like, people actually don't even think about it this way. Is it a tree or an herb? You know, like, what is the structure? And
Right. Where
are you finding it? And those kind of, once you start to understand this kind of, that way of thinking about the structure of it, it's really pretty easy to be able to identify plants. And then the next thing is to take, I think, just a few of them. Don't try and do like 100 and really get to know those plants.
We'll learn them one or two at a time.
Yeah.
And then your book also has, for people that love cooking, your book has some really good recipes for working with these plants, kind of above and beyond. Well, that's why it was nominated for the James Beard Award. High-end cooking, creative.
Yeah, but it's all been tested for home kitchens. And the interesting thing for us is that we actually, because it's so seasonal, of course, right, then it's not like you can just look up in a cookbook and be like, okay, here's another hamburger recipe. It has to be at the time in the season when the plant is there. But we've started kind of cooking through it. Every year you come back and like, okay, I won't be able to cook this again until next, you know, June or whatever the time is. And so it is kind of, for us and my family, it's sort of enjoyable in that sense.
Great. The book again is Forage Flavor, and the author is Tama Matsuoka Wong. And what's your website, Tama?
The website is meadowsandmore.com. Can I also point out that we have a plant ID forum. So for people who are just starting and are a little nervous, which is a good thing about their plant ID skills, we have a forum that is on our website and is moderated by one of the top botanists this side of the Mississippi.
Wow.
So, and he's retired, and he loves answering plant ID questions. But you do have to post a picture of more than like a dot of a leaf. but so, you know, the idea is for people to just appreciate what is around them, and that's where you can kind of start.
Great. What a great resource. And that's at meadowsandmore.com, and the book is Forage Flavor. And, Tama, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to more conversations like this.
Thank you, Ken. And, you know, I hope we can do our plan that we're planning something for October. That would be really fun.
Yeah, and it will happen. We'll figure it out. And I'll let everybody know we have an exact time and place.
Okay.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye.